Welcome to Holden Village's fabulous fireside room. Today the speaker is Ingrid Christensen, and she will be speaking on spirituality and sexuality, a story, the night we sang the Una Sancta. So let's listen in on Ingrid as she begins.
My name is Ingrid Christensen. I am going to lead a session today on a story written by Una Stoa Scar. And the story is out of a book of hers called Pillars of Salt, A Novel Told in Stories, which is on its way to the publisher but has not yet been published. And the stories are a series of stories about the event that happened in 1960, which was the merger of the three strains of the Lutheran Church that became the ALC. What was that, Danish?
ALC.
The Sad Danes and the ALC.
We were the happy.
The UELC too.
And the Germans. Germans were
the original American Lutheran Church.
Yeah, the original American Lutheran Church in 1960. The series of stories has, I think, eight different characters. Each tell the story of the convention or the singing of the Una Sancta at the end of the convention, the big piece that everybody sang together. And they're titled things like Such a Refuge, and then subtitled The Rape of Tamar. Sings Sorrow, The Sacrifice of Jephthah's Daughter, all these complicated ones. They That Mourn, The Sorrow of Dinah, The Pillars of Salt, The Song of Miriam, Dying of Time, Whiter Than Snow. But the one I'm going to sing is the night we sang, the Una Sancta, The Wife of Lot. And I'm going to start by reading the introduction to it, which is mostly because I'm charmed by it and it's short. There are a few things we can think about in the book. The book is a book about, I think, the tension between sensuality and spirituality as Lutherans. It's written by a woman who's a daughter of a Lutheran pastor and is thought a lot about what it meant to be raised in the church and to be a member of the church. And how sensuality is represented in this story is really through many ways, through the arts and music, through the five senses and things like hair and skin, through order and tension between order and disorder. Discipline, I think I misspelled discipline, didn't I? D-I-S. Whether your body is a temple or is, as we were saying yesterday evening, you know, sex is dirty, I'm going to save it for my husband. And spirituality, how is that played out here? Arts, music, body, order, discipline, a lot of the same things. One of the things that she plays with throughout this novel is the whiteness and lightness. So listen for those kinds of words in here. Also numbers, I think numbers are important in here. Tension between good and evil. You know, we're Lutherans, we know about that. Then she does do some stuff with gender differences, and I think it's interesting to see whether men fall into one set of patterns and women another, or whether what she views as the roles of men and women. In thinking back to those days in particular, 1960s, not that long ago, but, you know, some things have changed, but I think that what she says is relevant today.
Doris Day movies were still popular in 1960.
And not that much has changed. Then there's a question about age. The story that I'm going to read is told from the perspective of maybe a 10-year-old girl. So the sort of adult child stuff plays out. This child is called a chime child, and I haven't figured out why, but I'm hoping you all will tell me. And then communication. How is communication done among us Lutherans? Who does it? How do they do it? What's effective? So those are some questions I'd like you to keep in mind while I read. And then I'm hoping we'll have half the session to talk about it and you'll explain it to me. The night we sang the Una Sancta, there would never be another celebration like it. If it hadn't been for the singing of the Una Sancta, there wouldn't have been a celebration at all. The Constituting Convention would have finished on Saturday, and the 1,000 delegates, weary and hot from 5 days of debate and discussion, would have all gone home. The men who had come to Minneapolis to forge the new church were proud of themselves on that sixth day of June. They had done the job. The Norwegians, the Danes, and the Germans were finally one, willing to melt ethnic pride and doctrinal persuasion in order to be identified by belief and practice rather than country or language of origin. At noon on the first Saturday in June 1960, the American Lutheran Church was born. Delegates held hands and sang, "The church is one foundation," and some of the streaks running down hot faces were tears and not sweat. The delegates were tired. Many didn't want to stay for Sunday, for the service at Mount Olivet Lutheran, where communion would be served continuously from 9 until noon. Not everyone wanted to eat the smorgasbord prepared by the Friends of Faith, Bethel and Peace Lutheran Churches from 1 to 5 in the afternoon. And though they all wanted to attend the Una Sancta cantata that evening, most were so tired they would rather be getting on home. But the singers were coming for the concert. They were traveling from every corner of the country, humming the words under their breath, wearing flat shoes and carrying colorful robes, guiding children, greeting each other, carrying tins of Fatiman and Lefse to add to the smorgasbord tables, staying with relatives or sleeping in the basements of churches. Prepare ye, prepare ye, prepare ye. They were coming from as far away as Nome, Alaska and Miami Beach, Florida, from Seattle, Washington and Richmond, Virginia. They were coming from congregations in the Dakotas and the Carolinas, from churches in Vermont and Nevada. They were coming from colleges in Camrose, Puyallup, Decorah, Northfield, Moorhead, and Windsor. They were coming from seminaries in St. Paul and Saskatoon. They were coming from the Fox River and the Red. Like the people of Israel meeting to cross the River Jordan, they were coming by the thousands, crossing the hot country by car, by greyhound, and by train. I forgot to say, listen for water.
What?
Listen for water.
Okay.
Prepare ye, prepare. For the week preceding the singing of the Una Sancta, the Empire Builder, leaving daily from Chicago, was called the Lutheran Line. Families rode for a flat rate of $29 return, and supper for the whole family was free. In the dining car, the staff waited for grace before they served the meals, balancing food on the trays while they listened to "Praise God, from whom all blessings flow," or "Now thank we all our God." The singing continued in the cars in the evening. Noisy, the great northern attendant said. Noisy, but nice. You couldn't say the Lutherans weren't nice. Someone usually stood on a velour seat and led the rest in "How Great Thou Art," or "A Mighty Fortress," just before the train reached the cities. Conductors hummed those notes for weeks after the Lutherans left, though none of them knew the words. Prepare ye, prepare ye. No delegate left before the singing of the Una Sancta on that Sunday night in June. All stayed. And the story of the Una Sancta singing was told to the children and to the children's children. The story of the night the new church was sung into one. This is the story as told by Ann Abrams. The night we sang the Una Sancta, my mother said we should be ready to have our hair braided by 5:30. My gran always does the oldest, Leave and Astrid and Solveig, and mother does Christy, Karina, Dagny, and me, Anna Marie. I'm glad mother does my braids. She doesn't pull tight like gran, and she stops to talk while the rat tail comb sticks out of her mouth, and her fingers hold my braids like reins. When she finishes, our braids are loose and uneven and never stretch our skin. Gran's braids are as tight and perfectly patterned as stitching on a sewing machine and as hard to get out. Gran's braids last at least 3 days. My mother's don't last one. I washed my hair late in the day and my hair was wet when my turn came. "Please, can I leave it loose?" I whispered to mother. She looked at me. She always considers things, even if she's going to say no. "It's too wet," she said. "Your back will be soaked. Why did you wash it so late, Annie?" "You know why I washed it so late. I know you do. You know what shining ripples we can make if we braid our hair when it's wet, what magnificent waves erupt when we unloose the bands. You know why I washed it so late, and you know why I undid my braids before the singing of the Una Sancta began. You too have thrown your head back and felt your hair touch your thigh while you shivered in surprise. You too have swept your hair like feathers across your skin and have felt wet strands slide like searching fingers down your body. Like mine, your hair has moved like palms across your back, searching each curve, and has slid across your skin like a slow wind, soft and warm as breath. You too, I know, have stood in front of a long mirror and have wrapped yourself with hair, stroked it smooth against your skin, felt your nipples rise under fine lines of shifting silk. You know, I have only to remind you, and to ask, how can our bodies be temples if our hair is knit so tightly against unyielding bone of scalp that it cannot swirl or bend or give? Temples must be beautiful. I know you know that, too. To tell the truth, I didn't want to go to the Una Sancta service. Hadn't I heard every note 1,000 times before the singing started on that hot white night in June? Hadn't I heard my father composing at the piano and auditioning for a minister to read The Voice of the Lord? Hadn't I already seen Paul Bjornson's sketches for the Faith of Our Fathers mural? My father said for once there'd be space big enough for Paul's work. Paul could have had the whole front of the convention hall, my father said. He could make the men larger than life. He could put everyone on since Adam. He could do it any way he liked. But I don't do faces terribly well, Paul had said. I won't work with anyone else, Paul, my father had answered, and the committee wants Faith of Our Fathers. I don't like that theme much either, to tell the truth. I prefer something less prescribed, more abstract. More accurate, my mother had said quietly. And my father had said, laughing, make them all with their backs to us then, walking away, marching to the promised land. Then you won't have to paint their faces, Paul. And my mother had said slowly, now we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Her voice beat out the familiar words. You could put them all in a cloud, Paul. Then you wouldn't have to paint faces either. And she had put her hand on Paul's arm and left it there until she knew he didn't mind her words. Besides, she said, and I could hear her words coming warm and fast, then we could see the women better. Sarah and Dinah and Tamar and Miriam, all of them white as the wife of Lot, the Levite's concubine, Jephthah's daughter. Make them white, white as moonlight, Paul. And she said a lot more, fast and intense, but I didn't hear her words. I only felt the warmth. When Paul came, a light turned on inside her, and you could see and feel light shining through her pale, translucent skin like the sun that shone through our white teepee in the summertime. My mother was ethereal, as if she were made of shadow and dream and hope and not cells of flesh and blood. She was like a beacon, and she drew people to her as if she were a magnet made of light. So I knew exactly what the convention hall would look like before that night began. All spring, the seating plan had been spread out on our living room floor like a great wheel. From the hub, my father would direct the choirs who would stand in front of Paul's massive mural. Behind my father, all the congregating peoples of the three synods would fan out like the spokes of a wheel, like streams coming into one river, one church, Una Sancta. Hadn't I seen all those hot long days in June before the night happened, before the 7 chimes sounded, one for each of my sisters and the last for me? Chime child, my father says, because I am the 7th. So why did I go? I had seen it and heard it all, but my mother said we had to be there, all 8 of us, even Mark, who gets so terribly restless. Like the wings of a dove, she said, we'd sit on either side of her in the front row where seats had been reserved for us. This wasn't Sunday church, she said, where she was grateful if some of us stayed home. When we got to the auditorium, we found new hymn books on each of our chairs, bright red and stamped in gold. My father had let us choose all the hymns for the processional. He said it would take at least 30 minutes to get everyone in. We had chosen Children of the Heavenly Father for the cherub choirs, Thy Word is Like a Garden, Lord, for the seminary students, and For All the Saints Who from Their Labors Rest for the retired clergy. The students from the church colleges would enter on Rise Up, O Men of God, and for the missionaries, the ones that were home on furlough, that is, we chose From Greenland's Icy Mountains. When the missionaries entered, I saw that one of their children had braids hanging to her waist, stiff as pitchfork prongs and just as rigid. That's when I made up my mind. But as I stood up, the organ began, built on a rock the church doth stand, and I thought the sound would knock me down. Around me, everywhere, I felt expectation and elation, and I knew the delegates would be entering any minute. As I turned into the aisle, the double doors at the back of the auditorium opened, and the clergymen in black cassocks and white surplices and starched white collars swept in. 1,000 of them had marched all the way from Mount Olivet, where they had prayed together in one large gesture of unity. Their entry into the hall was like the arrival of a tidal wave. I met them halfway down the aisle and headed straight between them like I was the bow of a ship cutting through oncoming water. None of them noticed me. I could smell aftershave and talc and toothpaste. I could feel the smooth wool of their cassocks sweep against my legs and the white silk of their surplices swish against my taffeta skirt. I wanted to pull the ends of their embroidered stoles and make them uneven, or use them to brush the smiles off their faces. They were all carrying the new red hymnals high in front of them with their arms uplifted, though if you're a minister of the church, I think you should know the words. I didn't have a hymn book, and I didn't need one. Jesus to us the Spirit sent, making with us a covenant. I sang loudly over their tenor and bass voices as I passed between the ministers. I know my own and my own know me, and I let my body sway like a boat. I looked up and I could see the huge balconies hanging above me and filled with so great a cloud of witnesses. Everyone was standing, sending their voices out over the convention hall. At the organ, Naomi Sandy changed the stops with every stanza until at the last verse she pulled them all out and it was as loud as the trumpets that will announce the judgment day. I entered the women's room singing, "My peace I leave with you, amen," pitching my voice round and low. At the sink was a girl washing her hands. She had braids too, tight ones, nearly as long as mine, and tied with blue ribbons at the end. She stared at me through the mirror as I began pulling out my braids. "How will you get your braids in again?" she asks. "Who wants to get them in again?" I ask. My head is bent and turned to one side. The wet strands are sticking together and I have started too high. "Help me, won't you?" I say. She dries her hands carefully and starts low on the braid. I can tell she has done this before. You can't hurry braids. You have to unwind each strand. She is patient and careful, and I don't feel a snarl once. "If you don't have a comb, I can use my fingers," she says. And when I nod, she smooths each strand until all my hair is lying loose. "Now let's do yours," I say, when she is finished. "No, I don't want to," she says. "No." I shrug my shoulders. "Look," I say, and shiver like I have a chill. My hair slithers down my back. Then I toss my head to the left and my hair swings out. I toss to the right and it flies again, almost across her face. I lean forward and my hair makes a tent. Then I pull my hair across my face. "Guess whether I'm smiling or not," I say. "Guess." "You're not," she says. "I am too," I say. She grins at me and I know she guesses that I wasn't. "Where are you sitting?" I ask. "In the balcony?" "No," she whispers. "I'm in the front row." I stop and look at her very closely. I know the front row is reserved for the musician's family and for the family of the minister reading the voice of the Lord. "Stivia," I say slowly, "your father is Pastor Stivia." She nods. We look in the mirror. We are the image of each other, blonde hair, blue eyes, and tall. We could be sisters, we look so much alike. "I'm Anna Marie, Annie. Do you have a Norwegian or a Bible name?" "Bible," she says, "Elizabeth." We grin at each other, look in the mirror, and grin again. I close one eye, and so does she. I bow to her, and she bows back. "If you took your braids out, we'd look just alike," I say. "It's too late," she says. "We've got to get back." The choirs are filling up the dark lobby when we come out of the women's room. Choirs from congregations all over the country. Come, I whisper, and we climb up the stairs to the first landing where we can watch the choirs assembling. My hair feels as silky as the robes I see the singers wearing in shades of red and green and rust and blue, with white or gold stoles or none at all. We hear the organ playing the prelude for the choirs, the 8,000 people in the hall, the church choirs in the lobby, the ministers and interns, the missionaries and seminary students, the college choirs on the stage, the trustees and deacons and college presidents and professors, and Elizabeth and I hold our breath. And then, in one voice, the whole assembly begins, "Praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation." Elizabeth and I sit down on the top stair when the first stanza begins. By the second stanza, our feet are beating in time to the music. By the third stanza, I am on my feet, encircling a waltz. 1, 2, 3, health and salvation. 1, 2, 3, glad adoration. I take her hand and swing her as if we were turning a square dance corner. Square dance corner. 1, 2, 3, wondrously reigneth. 1, 2, 3, gently sustaineth. My hair is flying around my shoulders like curtains in the wind. She is giggling without making any noise, and though she looks worried, she is keeping up with me. "Take mine out," she whispers as we meet to join hands again. And I quickly undo the rubber bands and slide my fingers through the twists. As soon as I'm done, we swing in a circle one more time before we fly down the stairs, each of us balancing against one of the brass banisters, laughing as our hair sweeps out behind us like the wings of angels. The last robe is moving through the doors as we take our place. We don't need a hymn book. We know the words. We are daughters of the church, children of the Heavenly Father. We hold hands instead and take our first step into the hall together. All ye who hear, now to the temple draw near. My father is high on the podium at the center of the stage. The black tails of his tuxedo are swaying in time to the music. I can see his hands moving between the heads of the singers marching down the aisle in front of us. He looks like Moses with his arms uplifted, holding the advantage for Israel. Each pair of singers parts as they reach the rows where the church choir members are to sit. When the singers in front of us separate, I am looking straight at my father. He is so astonished that his arms stop moving and Ponder Anew is held by every singer in the hall. While we smile up at him, holding the note as long as all his singers do and smiling at him too. My father continues conducting as he walks down the stairs toward us. By the time the audience finishes the stanza, he is standing between us, holding one of our hands in each of his. In silence, we walk to the stairs, and then, still holding our hands, my father looks at the women. My father can let people know what he wants with a raised eyebrow or a turn of his head. I've seen it 100 times since then. The two women in the center, smiling at him, move slightly apart. My father guides us toward the stairs. I look up at him to make sure, and then I take Elizabeth's hand, and we go slowly up the stairs. For a moment, there is not a sound in the entire auditorium except the tapping of our patent leather shoes on the makeshift wooden stairs. We are welcomed into the center between the blue velvet robes of my father's college singers, and I feel a woman's arm slide around me. I position my feet apart like you must do when you sing in the choir, and I hold Elizabeth's hand as tightly as she holds mine. I am staring into spotlights and I cannot see beyond the circumference of the stage. And then my father enters the circle of light. He looks back and forth along the rows of the singers from face to face as if he sees them one by one. I know he makes the eyes of all the singers soften as they watch him. But not a muscle moves on any face. He nods his head and I hear a chord. There's a rustling of robes and a shuffling of feet as if a message had been sent and received. And I hear the words, "Den Stor wieder Flock." Wieder Flock. I don't know how to say that. I practiced earlier. As certainly, which means the great white flock. As certainly as if they had been spoken in my ear, which they have not, and I see my father's arms go up as quickly as a bird in flight and pause, and all around me I hear a quick intake of breath, and then the women, and only the women, began to sing the soft harmonious syllables. Who is this host arrayed in white, like thousand snow-clad mountain bright, that stands with palms and sings its psalms before the throne of light? My father smiles at Elizabeth and me, and we join in, our bodies swaying back and forth as if we were on a swing, rocking in time to the rhythm. See with new eyes the pattern of the seed. I know this hymn is not on the program, and I know it hasn't been rehearsed. But the women know all the words, every stanza, and so do we, Elizabeth and I, and we sing in unison as one voice, our voices filling the hall. O blessed saints, now take your rest, a thousand times shall you be blessed. I know the words as well as I know the letters in the alphabet, and so do all the women who are singing unaccompanied and in unison. My mother has sung this song to us at as a bedtime lullaby, and our family has sung it together in the car, often at night and perhaps after attending a concert of my father's. I have heard my parents singing it as a duet, sitting at the piano together, and each of them playing a part. I remember singing it at my grandfather's funeral, and I remember the weeping in the church when the congregation finished the last verse. After his death, I often found my mother in a dark room, humming the melody, sitting motionless and alone. When we finish, the audience rises to its feet, but there is no clapping, only silence, and many of them are crying, and I see my father is. He bows to the audience very low, and so does every singer on the stage, and then my father turns to the choir, and he looks at me, and I know. I squeeze Elizabeth's hand in case she doesn't know, and together we bow, just the two of us, and the hall is silent still. Then my father climbs the stairs of the podium and, with lifted and energetic arms, conducts the last stanza of the processional hymn. Praise to our God, who o'er all things so wondrously reigneth, shelters thee under soft wings, yea, so gently sustaineth. Hast thou not seen? I have seen. That night I saw. I saw song. I saw harmony. Song is visible, indivisible. Song is before the word and without the word. Song is from the beginning and in the beginning. And in song is the harmony that makes the fragments one, that makes the broken whole. In the silence after we had finished, I heard the clear call of the chime, like a knife slicing clean seven times. And the seventh for me, chime child, sounding the night I became a singer, the night we sang the Una Sancta, that night, unlike all other nights I have sung.
Wow.
Well, what can we say about it? I think Eunice is a wonderful writer. She's a... And she writes about her heritage and her history and her heart. She's very interested in the relationship between contemporary life and our faith and our roots and our heritage, so I always like reading her stuff. So, what strikes you?
Well, I get the parental relationship to mother and father. They understood each other, but differently. Mm-hmm. Lots of affection there for both her parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This girl child loved and benefited from both those parents.
Well, the Briggs, and then the grandmother, the older generation, and the mother, is the tight breed and the looser breed. Mm-hmm. And I almost thought of that as the church, too, as coming from the stricter background, woven together as a braid, but coming out a little looser, younger, freer. So there are a lot of symbolisms in that.
That generational stuff.
And wanting to loosen the braids, both girls.
Yeah.
Because it would be, you know, what was going on in her head. She wasn't where she was supposed to be sitting. I mean, it's kind of an incredible thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how many fathers would have absolutely, I mean, it'd have blistered her afterwards for sure. But she didn't get blistered. I mean, she became a young woman.
Yeah. That man, that father, seemed to recognize the importance of the generational.
You bet.
And to say that this children are part of this new church too.
Yeah.
And children of the Heavenly Father. That was interesting.
I know you do. I was thinking that all the way through this. I'm wondering where you fit into this thing, to tell you the truth. Since, you know.
Father would never in life have allowed this to happen.
Okay. And you never would have gone up there.
And I never.
Because you do. Editorial license.
Yeah, right. And the artist, of course, at the time was Cy Running, and so it's interesting that Eunice named the artist Paul, which is my father's name.
But
I think it's all of us. I mean, I think it's, you know, the father and the mother, the relationship with the child. To those, when you said that, I thought, well, that's sort of like all the branches of the church too. We're all children of all of those parents, the parental branches of the church that come together like streams, and all those people at the beginning crossing the rivers to get there on that the Amtrak train.
That's right.
And saying that
I thought it was interesting too that Children of the Heavenly Father is an Augustana hymn, and on the church, on this rock, the church to stand, is a Happy Dane hymn. And that was kind of fun to have that at the ALC convention, you know, which was kind of a foretaste of the feast to come.
Yeah. And Eunice said that she purposely put in hymns from the three traditions.
Yeah.
And then after she'd written the story, she wrote for the literature that was published about, because we'd forgotten. She'd forgotten what actually happened then. She wrote this fairly recently and found that they had done that.
They had actually done that?
Done that, yeah. Put in the hymns from the different traditions.
The interesting thing for me is the insight that reminded me of my own experience about that I had as a growing up in the physical response, the chilling and the excitement, the physical feelings of singing hymns that she shares, I mean, that she just kind of describes so explicitly, and how then she relates that to the same kind of feelings that she had around the physical touching that her hair did as it swept over the rest of her body. And that there was, for me, and I think I hear that in those words, for me there was a safety in having those sensual experiences in the context of worship and singing those hymns, because that was okay to do.
It was an awakening of her sexuality. I mean, I'm feeling in a very healthy way.
There aren't very many places in a highly structured family setting when those feelings are okay to glory in, so to speak, you know, to just revel in how they make you feel. Mm-hmm. And she revels in that in this story. Mm-hmm. And it draws you, it keeps you, it is an experience that keeps you in the church. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, I was in South Africa last year and I attended a worship service that I came to late, and I slipped in the back and stood where the men were in the back. And in South Africa they sing hymns still in wonderful 4- and 8-part harmony in all their worship services. And to be in the middle of all those men with those deep voices and hear them singing the bass and tenor parts, and it just resonated through my body. And I'd forgotten that experience because you don't get it that much in church anymore. But it came I went back to Trinity Lutheran in Moorhead just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very sensual experience.
I got so caught up with what happened to her and her mother in the beginning and how well she knew her mother. She kept saying, you know why I want my braces. You know what it's like to have your hair dance across your shoulders and your nipples. And that image, she writes so powerfully that I couldn't even hear most of what you said after that because I was still back with the little girl and her mother. And then what she said about her mother being a magnet and she drew people to her because she was almost translucent. And I got to hear, we've been in Berkeley all year, I got to hear Terry Tempest Williams. I don't know if you've read her, she's Mormon. She's been writing about ecology and the effect of the ecology on her mother and grandmother who have all died of breast cancer. Mm. She's a young woman who expects that she too will die of breast cancer. And she read from her new book, which is in our bookstore here. And I felt like I was in the presence of someone whose soul was about this close to her skin. She felt translucent. So I hope you tell your friend how much her writing touches us, because the depth of her images is very powerful.
I will certainly buy the book.
It's going to be, I think it's called
Pillar of Salt.
Pillar of Salt is the working title now.
It's just kind of a great title. I mean, with considering the women that are mentioned in those chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how it plays out through the whole book. I mean, she faxed all this to me the day before I came here, so I sat by my fax and more of it kept coming. And so I'm hoping to read more of it sometime in the next few days up here, but I know that she thinks that the whiteness and the light, white and light, and the pillar of salt all are very important symbols in this thing, but I don't really understand yet how they play out. But I wonder if you got anything from this portion of the book about that. I mean, she talks about the woman being this translucent and light and white. And she said at one point she wanted all the women to be painted white, all those biblical women. I don't know where that's going to go. Any idea?
I wanted to know what the mural finally was. Never did get the murals.
Well, Joanne, I will read more of this stack of stuff and see if it tells.
Well, certainly the women, you asked an earlier question about gender differences, and certainly the women in this story are the characters who seem most in touch with their sensuality. You know, where the men are more, I mean, the image of the clergy entering when everything was, you know, holding the books up and the manuscripts, so there's something kind of well-ordered. Whereas more the times that there was expressions of freedom in the body, that was happening in the women and the female characters and the characters in the story.
But at the same time, I think with the singing of Don Storo di de Foc, the conductor, the father in that, was making that, enabling that to happen. And while you have the women singing that, and that's the host arrayed in white, I mean, in a sense, that was kind of he was open to this too, right, in that. I mean, you have that other rigidity of that other, but there in this person, and the fact that the children were there, and that this song obviously came kind of up without accompaniment or whatever that.
Right, and so then you have to ask, what's the difference? And how does the musician get to be open and free, and have who is this host arrayed in white as the song that he chooses at that moment to sing, compared to those pastors hold in their black robes with white stoles holding the red hymn book out.
But he was married to that mother. you know, and she was the one that had talked about having the host, you know, and on the cloud. So, I mean, in a sense, you had the, that in that relationship there, that whether it was the effect of his living with that woman that made him open, or if they together had that.
And those seven daughters.
And the seven daughters.
Yeah.
You know, in that sense, he was different from the other men there.
And maybe there's something about the roles that everyone played. Maybe this is a, maybe this is saying that the arts are liberating in some way into your sensuality or into, you know, who knows what all those ministers were feeling as they were walking down the aisle, holding up their red hymnals and their black robes. But they had a different way of being characterized in here. And that child said she, I thought that was such a, an amazing image, when she went between them, all the way up the aisle, she said they didn't notice her. But she described all the ways that she felt and smelled them, the talcum powder, the toothpaste, the rough wool of their robes, the silk of their stoles. She was, and she was, you know, that's a very sensual, obviously, image to be, in a male image, to be penetrating that line of men. There were there was a lot of, I thought, pretty overtly sensual imagery in here.
Oh, yes. And sexual.
And sexual. Did it make any of you feel it was inappropriate or uncomfortable, or that it was the wrong, you know, in church to be feeling those feelings or any of that kind of? Those nipples rising didn't bother you at all?
Loved it. On the contrary, to have that weave of sexuality and spirituality is so filling for me, to not have the separation, to have them come together.
I wonder what connection there is between the formation of that church and the presentation of these two girls before their, the altar, and before their father, in the place that they were not supposed to be historically. And I think, if I remember her words, "And for the first time I sang with the choirs," or something like that, that in the new church, women took a new position at a, in a different way. I mean, what began to unfold then, not too many years later, was the ordination of women.
Mm-hmm. And one of the main themes that was used in this is, "For we all are one in Jesus Christ. There's neither Jew nor Greek, nor male nor female."
And the whole symbolism of, "I walked between them as they walked down the aisle, drawing into myself all the senses and feelings of all these men that had preceded me, and I walked in front of them to become part of the church in the fullest sense."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. That's, I think that is going on there. And then I wondered whether the fact that one had a Bible name and one had an ethnic name.
That was good.
Yes. Yeah.
I think, as you mentioned before, I mean, the when you braid, it takes three strands, and this was the three churches coming. And then, you know, when the one opened it up, it was that we were coming together, but then we need to let loose.
Oh, that's great.
You know,
mix it all.
And mix the church. I think that was an image that I think is very
It's wonderful, yes.
Yeah, thank you. I never thought of the three strands for the braids, but you're absolutely right. That's great.
Well, there were lots.
But to be one, you have to let loose the braid.
Yeah.
To be to be integrated.
Yes. But in a sense, you pull them together and then you release them.
But the braid is, each of the strands that makes the braid is a distinct strand.
Yeah.
It is not. Only by loosing the braid do you get one head of hair that flows.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering why she named this book this. I'm just looking at Genesis 19, where the Lord has decided to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham, please remember, for if you can find finally 10 righteous men, and of course we understand in the Jewish tradition that you can't form a synagogue and so on without so many men.
A minion.
Yeah. And so finally they don't find that many, but these two angels come to Lot's house, who's of course a nephew of Abraham. And the men of Sodom ask, turn those guys over to us. We want to know them. And wonderful here. He says, no, don't do that. I'll turn my daughters over to you.
Yeah.
You can violate them, but we're not going to violate the stranger in our midst.
Yeah.
You know, and then the angels say, get the hell out of here. You know, and flee for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the hills, or else you will be consumed. And then they go out and so on. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now it doesn't say anything about why she looked back. And I mean, I think the male assumption is that she disobeyed. But did she have pity and compassion upon those who were going to be consumed, and so she identified with them as she looked back? And the whiteness of the pillar. I mean, I don't think that's something that needs a little exegesis and explication as to what on earth is going on here. I'm sure she's going to be lauded in this book. I mean, the name of the book, Pillar of Salt. I mean, this a lot of meditation over that passage, I think.
Mm-hmm. But the Pillar of Salt is the translucent mother.
Well, yeah, sure, that is true, but what, I mean, the image of that, I think you're right, in this chapter, I mean, this is obviously, a unifying, integrating theme in this book.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it identifies a woman who traditionally, in our Bible studies in Sunday school, has been the disobedient one.
That's right.
And, which is a... I mean, we probably have a lot of sexism there, huh?
And then these two daughters were disobedient, and if those daughters were thrown to the... I mean, they
didn't go out. They didn't want the girls. They wanted the men.
Oh.
But I mean, the very fact that he offered them. And of course, the next time we have them go there, and then the daughters go in and uncover their father's nakedness and so on. And of course, he lies with them. I mean, it's a wonderful book.
A rich set of
I always like the story of Jacob's daughter Dinah, too.
And I think she does it. That's another chapter. That's another chapter. She does a lot of these women.
Who's raped by all the folks, you know?
And then left for dead on the doorstep in the morning. Is that the one?
That's not right. But then, and her brothers would become angry and. They say that these neighbors come down and say, we want to marry her into your family. And the brothers say, well, that's great, but we can't marry the uncircumcised. So you all got to get circumcised first. And then when all these men are sore from the circumcision, they go down and slaughter her. That's in the Bible.
Go down
and do likewise.
So why do they call her the chime child? And why are those seven chimes for the seven daughters? Is there symbolism that you can understand out of that?
Well, seven's a lucky number.
Seven is probably religiously significant.
She was the seventh daughter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Do we normally ring chimes seven times at the end of a church? Or
no.
Is there any time?
Three.
But there, no, don't they?
Oh,
we always, when I was growing up, the chime rang more than three times.
Yes,
but
right.
It rang on the Father and on the Son and on the Holy Spirit, but it rang beyond.
Were there three sets of threes or something? I'm trying to remember. How did they do that?
Doesn't sound like any of us understand that, but I have a feeling it's symbolic. What else did I wonder about?
Maybe it's just simply that as a musician, you would be tuned in to that there are, there it rings seven times, and seven times there was a girl.
And then there was this Mark who was restless in church. Their eighth child.
Little Mark.
I have some other questions here. How about discipline? Did you sense anything about discipline, the importance of discipline, whether discipline is a set of rules, or it's a negotiated thing, or?
Oh, it's definitely negotiated between herself and her mother, not with her grandmother. I think if she had her grandmother put her hair up, she wouldn't dare taking it down.
But she
already knew she was going to take it down. And her mother probably knew she was going to take it down, but maybe not during the service. But, you know, she sneaked back in the bathroom. When you were reading that, I was reminded of a kid that I went to school with, my friend that lived next door. She was a year younger, and her grandmother would put her hair around her finger very tightly, make a curl, and put a bobby pin in it. And she was to leave those in until she got to school, then remove the bobby pin. So then her hair would hang down and it would be in ringlets. And it was a beautiful hairdo. I mean, it was just absolutely gorgeous. And it took her grandmother about, oh, I don't know, half an hour every day before she went to school to do that. Of course, as soon as we got around the corner, out came all of the bobby pins. And Pauline would take this beautiful head of black hair and just slam it around and until it was all out, and there would just be a little bit of curl right at the bottom, and it was just, I mean, it was even prettier that way. But I always thought she does that in defiance of her straight-laced, or more straight-laced grandma. It was wonderful story.
My grandmother was, I stayed on the farm every summer in southern Minnesota, and she had a couple of rats, you know, which is from her own hair, which supplements the hair. And she very, I mean, it was perfectly braided, but it was plaited, and then wrapped around her whole head. So she had this, every morning she made that up. You know, I was thinking about my grandma. Mm-hmm. And she would have tied a tight braid, I'll tell you.
It was interesting. She knew she needed the braid to get the curl she was going to have later. She refers to that. Mm-hmm. And she knew she needed the braids because it makes this wonderful flow and curl in her hair.
Because it makes it wavy.
So the braid was necessary, and that's symbolic too, almost. Mm-hmm. The necessity of tradition and the three coming together. And knowing that would make a new hairdo almost, or a new... Blow to her hair, and
that's a good point.
So it became a new, something new, and it was down and flowed together.
I was interested in your comment when you were talking about your own life, and you said you would never have run up through that crowd of men, and your father would not have encouraged you to be unaltered. Is this the adult woman, your friend, wanting that kind of openness from this culture to have happened in that time?
Something in me prefers order to disorder in a performance, so I wouldn't want any kids running up there, you know, doing that. I mean, on the other hand, the order of this work of art that I just read to you is very satisfying to me.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that as children, we were aware of. We were surely aware of our limitations because we were girl children. And all the way through college we talked about it a lot. And our moms were sort of encouraging us to be as obstreperous as possible. So I told a story a couple days ago in one of this conference we were at. My father playing the piano. I was sitting upstairs studying in my bedroom. My father was downstairs playing the piano, and he crashing it louder and louder for some reason. He was just, it was very unlike him to sort of get out of control, but he was approaching, getting out of control on the piano for some reason which I didn't know anything about. And he came, finally, he slammed on the cover of the piano and he ran up the stairs, barged into my bedroom and said, "Don't you ever do anything out of fear of hell." And he turned around and walked out. I said, okay. But I have no idea what that was about. But he was a very, he is a very emotional and romantic man in lots of ways. So that is in character. I mean, she's not writing exactly about my father in here, but that certainly is in character with him. I wondered about women's and men's roles here differentiated in terms of a whole list of things. Responsibilities. You know, the women are responsible for the domestic things in this story, basically, but also that mother suggested to the artist what he should do, and the artist listened. So it was a sort of, that was our traditional way of having power, was manipulating men behind the scenes. The men had the overt responsibility, the public responsibility, but the women had the responsibility in the choir of being sensitive to the director, knowing what he wanted, responding to what he wanted, that whole thing. Artistic responsibilities, again, it sorted out. The public people were the men, the more private were the women. In terms of communication, it seems like they all had a lot of communicative skills. The artist said he couldn't paint faces, but he obviously could communicate through the art. And the musician could communicate through raising an eyebrow or his expression, his hands. The mother communicated when she would be braiding the hair, she would stop and hold the braids like reins and listen and consider a request from the child and communicated effectively with the child. And when she communicated with the artist, the mother put her hand on his arm until she could feel that he was listening. So there was a sort of sensual level of communication, physical level. I don't think that, I mean, good and bad or good and evil kinds of things didn't sort out. I didn't think sorted out by gender in here. Was there evil in this? Was there any place where something was bad or negative or scary? And I don't even think we got the sense that the grandmother's braids necessarily were evil. They were just different. That was another way.
It's just more rigid.
Yeah, and it was the older church. And the words like rigid were used a few places in here. I guess the men holding out the books.
I think they're boundary symbols. This is the edge of a boundary. The rigidity of the braids that won't come out. The symbols are in, they're symbols of kind of boundaries that we, and the children ran down, I mean, she runs between these two lines, which are the boundary, to explode into a new place, to go beyond the boundaries.
She broke those boundaries. Yeah.
And Elizabeth was confined at first by the boundary. We don't have time to take that, which was more, that wasn't quite the boundary that she really had. But then she was lured into it because she saw the joy of being free.
Right.
So help me.
Mm-hmm. That wonderful dancing.
Oh, too. Yes.
Praise to the Lord.
Yeah, you said something about they were kind of inaugurated into womanhood. Is that, did I hear that from somebody? I mean, it was like they were inaugurated, or they, and I thought, yes, they were, and they joined the choir. When I was in junior high, my dad had an encounter with the Mormon Church. And I had spent 2 years going with my friends to the Mormon Church and enjoying it very much. And in fact, my dad took me to the Golden Green Ball. And there's a lot of family stuff in the Mormon Church. And so we were doing that. And I can't remember this also. The missionaries came to a place in their little spiel with my folks about the three heavens and how the Mormons in good standing will be in the highest heaven and so on and so on. And I have a brother that died when I was a child, and my dad said, well, where is Billy? Which one of the three heavens is Billy in? Well, sorry, you probably won't be with Billy in heaven. And suddenly the missionaries found themselves out on the porch, and I was in my first pair of high heels and nylons singing in the choir in the Methodist church the next Sunday. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was instantaneous. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that being inaugurated into the choir is a new ritual in place of maybe communion or first communion or something that we used to have.
It was a rite of passage
in
the church to be able to sing in the adult choir.
And
the last, that's a good point. The last thing I wanted to say, because it's time for us to end and go have some lunch soon, is that there was a third child with long blonde braids in here. And there were, since there were three churches coming together and there's three parts to a braid and there are all these threes. Remember the missionary child with braids like pitchforks?